Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
We're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Can you imagine, just for a moment, just imagine, what if the government came to us and said, you know, for every man, woman, and child in the United States, the average income, of course, in the United States is around $45,000 a year. You look over the last 5-6 years, the numbers have fluctuated a little bit. Sometimes they quoted at 44, the median income, the median household income. Sometimes it's 46, but you know, let's say $45,000 a year. And, of course, after you pay taxes on that and everything, it's probably around 35, you know, when all is said and done, money left over. If the government came and said, you know, we want you to give us $38,616. In other words, all of your income, all you average wage earners. And we're going to give that money to the billionaires and trillionaires who run our banking system. Sound like a good deal? I don't think so. I want to tell you about that today. In the second hour of our program, Martha Burke, the editor, the money editor for Ms. Magazine, is going to drop by. She's the author of Your Money and Your Life, The High Stakes for Women in 08, How to Avoid Being a Bag Lady When You Retire If You're Female. And certainly there's a lot of lessons for men in there as well. In our third hour, also Dennis Rivera, the chair of the SEIU Healthcare Programs, is going to come by and talk about what's the status of healthcare in this country. In our second hour, Carrie Lucas, the Vice President of Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum. Her question, and she's been writing about this, this should be an interesting conversation. She says, well, if the Obama kids get school choice, shouldn't everyone? But anyway, in our first hour, I want to talk about the situation, the state of the economy here. Where are we going? I'm telling you, 6 months from now, a year from now, Americans, much like in 1935, Americans are going to understand the economy as well as they understand the Super Bowl, and some of them a whole hell of a lot better. We just, by the way, we just got off the cruise ship last night. Louise and I got home. We spent a week on the Air America cruise, and a tip of the hat and many, many thanks to Lee Rayburn from Milwaukee and Jay Marvin from Denver, who filled in for us during that week. And I know Lee had a particular, the first day the phones crashed, and so he had to just do a song and dance for 3 straight hours. And that's, I'll tell you, that's a talk show host nightmare. So Lee did a great job, and thank you to both of them and to all the folks at Air America who helped make it happen. On the cruise, we had a great time. We visited Belize, and there was a fellow on the cruise who actually lives part of the year in Belize and has for 16 years. And he put Rachel and I and one other guy in his truck that, you know, a Belize truck, and drove us all over the country. We saw the capital city. We went to the zoo. This is a zoo that was founded by a former exotic dancer and now is a really nice zoo. You can literally walk up to the jaguar cage. It's just like, you know, not chicken wire, but that stuff with the square holes that's about 4 inches wide and 2 inches high, you know, the wire fence, and put your hand through the fence if you want to have the jaguar eat your hand off. And so the howler monkeys, they make this incredible noise like lions. Anyhow, all the animals were indigenous. It was fabulous. And Louise was just, you know, from cat to cat, she was entranced. In Mexico, we stopped in Mexico, and there was this guy with this little monkey. This little monkey, you know, like 4 inches tall. And he was standing on by the dock coming out to the ship, and encouraging tourists to put the monkey on their shoulder and then give him a tip. And as we walked by, I said to Louise, I wonder what the odds are of the monkey shall we say, letting go on somebody's shirt? You know, do you think they're 1 in 10, 1 in 20, 1 in 30? Does this guy, you know, does he have to play the odds? I mean, how does it work? How frequently, you know, is it a down thing or an up thing for him? I mean, if the monkey lets go on somebody's shirt, do the guys at the end of the day all sit around and say, did you see that one woman's look on her face? I got the guy who was kind of rude in the stand. I got the guy who didn't pay the tip or who haggled the price. You know, do they sit around laughing at the tourists that the monkey pees on kind of thing? Anyhow, as we were walking back to the ship, we were debating the odds. I says, I'll bet it's 1 in 10 or 1 in 20. And Louise was like, no, come on, that's a really well-trained monkey. He never pees on anybody. We get back to the ship, and a few minutes later, Ron Reagan shows up, and his shirt is all wet. Ron, the monkey got Ron. Yes. So a variation on Reagan trickle-down economics, I guess. I don't know. Ron, hanging out with Ron Reagan was a real pleasure, as it was with Lionel and Mark Green and David Bender. We had a great time. There was one woman who was living 16 years on the cruise ship. 16 years. And when you think about it, I mean, you know, a cruise, you can get a bottom-end cruise for about, you know, $1,200 and, you know, for 7 days. And that's not even $200 a day, and you know, which is a whole lot less than most retirement communities charge. And this includes all your meals. It includes travel. You know, it's a hotel. It's your hotel room. You travel all around the world. You never have to unpack. You're waited on hand and foot, 24-hour food, anything you want. There's a doctor on ship. There's a nurse on ship. There's a clinic on ship. There's movies. Every day there's different three, four different movies. There's entertainment every night. The question that Louise and I spent like 2 hours kicking this around, you know, gee, here's a business opportunity. Maybe we should look at this. Because back in the day, must be 15 years, 20 years ago, there was a ship called the Jupiter. It was owned by Kyros Lines, K-Y-R-O-S, which is owned by Mr. Kyros. And there was a German businessman who wanted to buy this ship. And he didn't speak any English or any Greek. And he was good friends with Mr. Mueller, who is sort of my mentor. He's the guy who started the Salem International Organization. It's the group that I've done nonprofit work with all over the world. We set up a refugee center in Uganda. We started a blind children's and orphans and leper colony program, or we took them over, actually, ones that were failing in India. We started a program in the slums, the La Paz slum of Bogota, Colombia. We started a program in Russia and Kaliningrad that's still doing very well. My employee at the time, or the number two guy in our program, the Community for Abused Kids that we started in New Hampshire, the New England Salem Children's Village, salemchildrensvillage.org, by the way, if you're looking for a great place to make a donation this year, was Hal Cohen. Hal Cohen was my right-hand man. He was the program director. I was the executive director, which is basically the fancy title for the guy who raises the money and signs the checks and makes everything work. Hal was the program director, the guy who works with the kids and the staff and everything. And Hal was, Herr Mueller came over and asked Hal, you know, what would you like to do? And Hal said, I'd love to go start a program like this in Israel, because Hal's Jewish and he's very, very, has always felt very bonded to Israel. And so Hal and his wife Shelley went over, you know, Herr Mueller raised some money for them, and we helped out a little bit. And Hal and Shelley, and they had some, and Hal and Shelley went over to Israel and they started a program called Or Shalom, which is now the largest child caring community in the entire country. So, in the entire country of Israel, with homes for Arab kids, Jewish kids. It started out just Jewish kids, Christian kids, secular, highly Orthodox. So, anyhow, we've seen these programs all around the world, and we've been involved in setting up a lot of them. And so Louise and I were speculating about what would it take to set up a program on a cruise ship, a program for people, let's say, over 40, maybe over 50, who have just decided, okay, time to check out. You know, I'm going to take some time off. I'm going to take some time off and retire. And in fact, the Jupiter, this one ship that I was telling you about, I was traveling on that ship with Herr Mueller because we were going to buy the ship, or this this I forget his name now, this German friend of Herr Mueller's wanted to buy the ship, and he wanted me to be the translator, so I ended up negotiating with this Greek ship owner to buy this ship. I was pretty surprised. It was a very interesting insight. So I thought, well, what if we were to buy, and by the way, 2 years later, the ship sank in the Mediterranean. Good thing we didn't buy it. But what if we were to buy a cruise ship, strip the thing apart, And, you know, you'd probably have to expand the hospital and clinic and make the rooms larger so people could have their knickknacks and things and turn it into a floating retirement community. Not a bad idea, I think. I don't know. Maybe somebody will do it. And Miss Bunny showed up, complete with ears and nose, first night. The famous Bunny from Houston, one of the people. So anyhow, that's what happened on our cruise ship. I just, you know, I'd tell you our vacation was a fine one. So here, the Fed, $7.4 trillion. I'm going to tell you about this after the break. This is mind-boggling. 33,000 per dollars per person or more. Let me share these numbers with you. What's going on? Are we standing on the edge of a great hyperinflation? 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to Teamster.com. You know, the average American thinks that the extent to which we the people, the government, we the people collectively, the extent to which we're bailing out, as it were, the banks. I mean, that's the phrase, right? Bailing out the banks And we'll bail out the guys, you know, the Gucci loafers and the $700 suit guy or the $7,000 suit guys. We'll bail them out, the Maserati driving bankers. But we're not really sure we want to bail out the guys who work at GM and Ford because after all, they're just, you know, blue collar Americans. I mean, you know, it's, are you sure you want to bail out the blue collar guys? I don't know. Prevailing. So that seems to be the debate. And we're talking about $700 billion, which is about the, you know, a little larger than the defense budget, which is about half the federal budget, you know, compared to the discretionary budget. It seems like a lot of money. Seems like an enormous amount of money. But literally, to use the tip of the iceberg metaphor, you know, 90% of an iceberg is underwater. This is just the tip of the iceberg of what is being given to the wealthy and powerful in the United States, while at the exact same time the Bush administration and Congress, and in Congress, by the way, is doing this in large part because the efforts to help working people have all been filibustered by Republicans, so they're left with nothing else. And Congress have been handing off money or guarantees of money to the very wealthy, the very well-to-do. So, you know, to what extent would that be? It's really incredible when you start looking at all the numbers. Okay, you just start looking at it. Here's from Bloomberg. Bloomberg is actually engaged in a lawsuit against the federal government to find out how much money is being used, how many taxpayer dollars are being borrowed in our name or are being taken out of our taxes. And keep in mind, the vast majority of it's being borrowed in our name. How many of these taxpayer dollars are going to support these large, in many cases, transnational corporations? In many cases, corporations that are in part owned by overseas interests, or that, for example, like General Motors, doing a lot of business overseas. Their most profitable divisions are in South America, for example. So, you know, they manufacture in Argentina and Brazil. Flex fuel cars, by the way. They manufacture in Europe cars that average miles per gallon in the 40s, but they can't do that in the United States. But I digress. Today in Bloomberg, you can read this over at Bloomberg.com, article by Mark Pittman and Bob Ivry. U.S. taxpayer, the U.S. government is prepared to lend more than $7.4 trillion on behalf of American taxpayers, or half the value of everything produced in the nation last year. half of our GDP, our gross domestic product is about $15 trillion. We're going to loan half of that in 1 year? They say the Treasury Department's $700 billion TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program, lending last, you know, it's just the beginning of it. The commitment dwarfs the only plan approved by lawmakers. None of this has been approved by Congress, by the way. It's just being done by mostly the Fed and the FDIC. Federal Reserve lending last week was 1,900 times the weekly average for 3 years before the crisis. The Fed has already bought $2.4 trillion in commercial paper. In other words, loans that companies have put out. You know, you're running a business, you want to borrow money, you issue IOUs. Fed has bought $2.4 trillion of that. They threw $29 billion into Bear Stearns. They threw $306 billion into Citigroup yesterday, on a Sunday, no less. The Treasury Department's going to inject an additional $20 billion into the bank after its stock fell 60% last week. That's going to happen today. Now, compare this. The S&L bailout in 1990s, during the first Bush recession, the first major recession, $209 billion in inflation-adjusted dollars, $173 billion that came from us. That's nothing. The 1979 bailout of Chrysler, that cost $4 billion for comparison purposes. And as Ravi Batra suggested on this show a week ago Friday, the capitalization right now, the market cap, the value of General Motors, if you just went out and bought all the GM stock today, you could buy General Motors for $1 billion. You could buy Ford for $3 billion. So why not buy Ford and GM for $4 billion? And then take an additional, say, $10 or $15 billion and give it to the companies, but take all that stock that you bought and give it to the employees based on their seniority. Everybody who's worked there more than a year, if they've worked 10 years, they get 10 shares of stock. If they've worked 1 year, they get one share of stock, that kind of thing. Only it wouldn't be a share, it would be a percentage of the total pot. And then say in 3 months, you're going to have a board of directors meeting, and this new board of directors, which is made up entirely of workers in the company, is going to vote in a new board of directors. And that new board of directors is going to hire new officers, and those new officers are going to run GM and Ford. And you would have a whole new day. And this would be a bailout that would cost nothing. But here we have the government, our federal government, spending $7.4 trillion, half of our GDP, to bail out who? The rich.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
664-3222-70. 34 minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And hey, it's a happy day for us. Sean Taylor, my executive producer, is back after, geez, how long has it been gone? You've been gone, Sean?
It's about 2.5 months.
That long?
It's been forever.
I've been doing this show all alone in the studio. Louise has been with me about 3/4 of the time, but all last week and the week before, I was all alone here.
I was piloting from the couch.
Yep, and back in your home and your houseboat up on the Columbia. And you've been, it's been a good exercise for us all in remote control radio.
But it's good to be back.
Yeah, it is. It's good to have you back. Thank you, Sean. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Louise is in the studio with us today, too. And Sean, by the way, broke her ankle in 3 places. She's had 3 surgeries over the last 3 months. And now she's hobbling around on an air cast, so... Anyhow, great to have you with us. And our quote of the day is from Sean Hannity. I've been racking my brain to find methods of openly, actively, and legally opposing this tyrant, that would be Barack Obama, in the making. Any suggestions? I'm sure, Sean, if you simply ask, the Republican National Committee will be glad to provide you with, oh, they already are providing you with talking points. Excuse me. So let me just finish my riff in less than a minute and a half, and then I'll pick up your phone calls at 866-303-2270. You can also drop into our live chat room at tomhartmann.com, and you can find our live video stream. There's a link to it from tomhartmann.com. It's also on our pages over at airamerica.com. But I got this email today from Steve, and he says, okay, I'm not an economist, but this isn't rocket science. $7.4 trillion for the bailout. $7.4 trillion is, you know, $7.4 billions, or $1,007.4 millions, or $100,074,000, or $200,037,000. Now, there's only 125 million working families in the United States, so that means that somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000, $60,000 per working family this year is going to bail out the masters of the universe, as they loved to call themselves. So you want an economic stimulus, since wages are the only driver of supply in the United States, not banks, not corporations, not anything. Wages are the driver of supply because it puts money in consumers' hands. If you're going to bail somebody out and you're going to borrow the money to do it, why not, as Franklin Roosevelt did indirectly with the WPA and the CCC and the AA, all these different groups, why not simply take that $40,000 or $50,000 a year per working person in the United States and give it to the working people in the United States? Only don't give it to them as a one-time handout. That's just a short-term stimulus, and it doesn't structurally fix anything. Why not immediately pass the Employee Free Choice Act so that large chunks of the American workforce are unionized, they get to demand higher wages, let's raise the minimum wage up to $14, $15, $16 an hour, and let's go back to Teddy Roosevelt's 1913 suggestion when he was running the Bull Moose Party, let's go back to Teddy Roosevelt's suggestion that a living wage is necessary. That nobody in America who actually has a full-time job should have to worry about whether they can buy a home, whether they can buy a car, whether they can put their kids through school, whether they have enough money for retirement, and whether or not they can take a vacation. Those were Teddy Roosevelt's five simple criteria for a living wage. Let's require a living wage in America. If you did that, there would be so much demand in the marketplace that these companies would not go bankrupt, because we, the people, would be using their services and funding them. Real simple. Peter in Albany, Georgia. Hey, Peter, welcome to the show. Peter, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hey, Peter, what's up?
Hey, I just had a question for you, okay? Are we bailing out the big three up there, or are we bailing out the unions, which have sucked the companies down to nothing?
It's not the unions that have sucked the company down to nothing, Peter. The unions represent people who are paid a decent wage. I'm guessing that you're part of the crowd that thinks that if somebody working in a union is making a good enough living that they can actually buy a home and put their kids through school and have a decent retirement, that that's a bad thing, and that all the rest of us should be making what people make at Walmart.
Well, no, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying,
well, that's what you just said. You said the unions are sucking the companies dry.
$60 an hour?
I beg your pardon?
$60 an hour, is that enough?
I think if you're including pensions and you're including health care, money that's going to be spread over a person's lifetime, yeah, that's not unreasonable. But the fact of the matter is that most people who work for unions don't make anything close to $60 an hour. They're making between $20 and $35 an hour. And at that range, you are in the American middle class. What's wrong with that, Peter?
Okay, now, how much does an American car go for? How much does a company actually make after a car has been sold?
What does it matter?
What do you mean?
Here's the question for you, Peter. Why do we have an economy?
Are we spending...
No, wait a second, Peter. Why do we have an economy? Why do we want to make cars in the United States?
So we can get around, so we can drive.
No. No, I'm sorry. Not the case. There's a thousand ways to get around. We could choose to have mass transit. We could choose. There's the reason that we want to make cars in the United States is so that workers will have jobs. The fundamental thing that, Peter, you've been listening too much to right-wing talk radio and too much to people, you know, like Ali Velci and these so-called commentators on CNN. The purpose of an economy is to provide a stable living for the workers, for the citizens. We have a citizen-driven economy, not a consumer-driven economy. And so if a company cannot do business when they're paying their workers a decent wage, that company has no right to be in business. And if the only way a company can stay in business and the only way a company can be profitable is by paying people so little money that they can't afford health care, they can't afford to pay for their kids' education, they have to run themselves into debt, they can't afford to take a vacation, they can't afford to pay into a pension that will take care of them in their old age, then that company has no right to be in business in this country.
Okay, but I live in the country. Where's my public transportation?
Well, there is none, by and large. And again, I would suggest that you talk to the Republicans about that as well, because every effort to pass significant public transportation legislation in the United States to provide for public transportation for 60 years, for 80 years, has been fought by the Republican Party.
Let's just raise taxes and suck more money out of the companies.
Would you rather borrow more money? Peter, what Reagan did is he borrowed more money in 8 years than every president from George Washington to Ronald Reagan combined. He spent that money to make it look like we had a decent economy. And this year, if you're earning the median income in the United States, let's say you're earning $50,000 a year, about $2,000 of the taxes you're paying this year go to pay for the interest on the debt that Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. and George Bush Jr. ran up. Now, do you really think that's reasonable?
Oh, wait a minute, wait a minute. Oh, now, when George Bush was in office, didn't we have a surplus?
No.
No? Oh, what about Clinton? When he was in office, didn't we have a surplus?
Yeah, that's what happens when you elect Democrats.
Didn't Ronald Reagan bring the interest rate and all of that stuff down? Didn't he do that?
Ronald Reagan gave us in 1982, after his tax cuts, after he dropped the top tax rate on the wealthiest in America from 74% down to 27%, we saw the worst recession since the Great Depression, and it was even worse in 82 and 83 than it is right now.
But didn't he also create 23 million jobs?
Every president creates new jobs, Peter. The nature of an economy in a country where the population is continuously increasing is that you're continuously creating new jobs. We have to create 150,000 jobs a month just to keep even. Every president created new jobs. The president who created the most, if you want to look at the last six presidents, was Bill Clinton. The president who created the least was George W. Bush. Ronald Reagan's record on creating jobs was relatively unspectacular. He did not create anywhere near as many jobs as, for example, Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, for that matter.
What's the difference between the auto workers up there in Detroit and the same people down here in the South that don't have a union and are doing just as good? And their cars are selling just as good, and they don't have problems in their plants.
You're talking about people who are working in the Toyota plants for about 40% less wages than people who are working in the GM plant?
You don't see them people complaining. I have a son that works at BMW.
Hey, I don't see,
right down here in South Carolina.
I don't see people at Walmart complaining. Instead, what I see them eating is dog food. You know, what you're arguing, Peter, is a race-to-the-bottom argument, and I don't understand how, as an American, either you hate your country or you don't understand basic economics. How can you suggest that we should all be engaged in a race to the bottom? That because some people among us have fought and died and worked for years and years and years to get a decent wage, that they're paid too much? Shouldn't we be working to get everybody else paid as much?
Well, if you get everybody getting the same rate of pay, there's no underclass, right?
That would be a fine thing.
Okay.
That's like how it is in Denmark and Sweden and Norway. I beg your pardon?
You build a pyramid from the top down?
I beg your pardon?
Can you build a pyramid from the top down?
So you're saying you have to have a poor in order to support the rich?
That's the way the economy works, whether you like it or not.
Well, it's not the way the economy works in France. It's not the way the economy works in Denmark. It's not the way the economy works in Sweden. It's not the way the economy works in Switzerland. By and large, it's not how the economy worked in the United States in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Yeah, let's talk about Sweden. They only work 4 days a week, and whenever they make a certain amount, they have to hand it over to the government. Is that what you want?
You know, if you're working 4 days a week and you're making a good, solid living and college is free and health care is free and you can make... You know, the top tax rate in Sweden doesn't kick in until after you're making $3 million a year, Peter. Yeah, I think that's a fine thing. I think that's a fine thing. I'd like to see that here in the United States. All in favor of it. A large middle class. Go for it. 45 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to the program. From the wire services, as they say, in the first 2 weeks since the election, President-elect Barack Obama has broken with a tradition established over the past 8 years through his controversial use of complete sentences, political observers say. Millions of Americans who watched Mr. Obama's appearance on CBS's 60 Minutes on Sunday witnessed the president-elect's unorthodox verbal tic, which had Mr. Obama employing grammatically correct sentences virtually every time he opened his mouth. But Mr. Obama's decision to use complete sentences in his public pronouncements carries with it certain risks, since after the last 8 years, many Americans may find his odd speaking style jarring. According to presidential historian Davis Logsdon of the University of Minnesota, some Americans might find it alienating to have a president who speaks English as if it were his first language. Says Mr. Logsdon, every time Obama opens his mouth, his subjects and verbs are in agreement. If he keeps it up, he is running the risk of sounding like an elitist. The historian said that if Mr. Obama insists on using complete sentences in his speeches, the public may find itself saying, okay, subject, predicate, we get it, stop showing off. President-elect's stubborn insistence on using complete sentences has already attracted a rebuke from one of his harshest critics, Governor Sarah Palin of Alaska. Said Governor Palin, talking with complete sentences there, and also, too, talking in a way that ordinary Americans like Joe the Plumber and Tito the Builder can't really do there. I think needing to do that isn't tapping into what Americans are needing also. Mm-hmm. And thanks, tip of the hat, to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, for our insight for the day. Michael in Eureka, California. Hey, Michael, listening on KGOE. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I've been, by the way, it's great that they're starting to appeal with people that can actually think instead of people that they think can't think. There's this great bulletin that I get. I don't get it completely because it costs 200 euros a year, but it's called the Global European Anticipation Bulletin. And it's put out by a group called LEAP, and it's Europeans. But these people actually made predictions. They make, tell you what it's for. It's for people who are concerned about worldwide markets and who invest in the worldwide markets and follow the trends. And they're for real. I mean, they're in, you know, they're
Global European Anticipation Bulletin.
Yes, okay. Yes. And they predicted the September stock market crash back in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So they're pretty accurate. And what they're predicting now is pretty frightening, and this is the stuff that goes out to their people, but is that the United States will default on its debt in the summer of 2009.
That would be very bad. But the way that we're racking up debt right now, frankly, either we're going to have massive tax increases or we're going to inflate our way out of it, or we'll default. And I don't think that we'll default. I think if we defaulted, it would be a disaster, an unimaginable disaster.
They've been defaulting. They've been saying that there's going to be a very great U.S. depression.
Yeah.
And that we will default, similar to what Iceland did.
Yeah.
And that we could wake up one morning with $30,000 in the bank, and the next morning have $10,000 worth with new currency.
Or 300, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I revalue our currency. I was in Israel when they revalued their currency. They just took a zero, or maybe it was two zeros off the end of the shekel. Sometimes revaluing currency is not a terrible thing because the purchasing value goes up, by 100% as the numbers go down. But I still wouldn't recommend that for the United States. We have created a real crisis. I mean, $12 trillion debt is massive. And the fact that this year we're spending $7.4 trillion, the Fed is loaning out much of this with no congressional oversight at all. The Fed is not even a government agency, but they control our money supply. This has to be exploding, the number of dollars in circulation. And we don't have anything to balance it. There was an op-ed piece in today's Financial Times saying the U.S. needs to go back on the gold standard. And I think this is the Europeans, this is the rest of the world saying, you guys don't get control of your currency, there's going to be a disaster coming.
This is exactly what they're talking about in this month's bulletin, is that this is the downfall of the Bretton Woods structure,
yeah.
Which, is the gold, when we got off the gold standard.
Well, we didn't leave the gold standard until 71. It was Nixon that did that, or 72.
Right.
But I would say that what we're seeing is the downfall of neoliberalism. We're seeing the downfall of Reaganomics. Reagan came along with this idea that if you cut taxes on the top, it's going to create wealth. Well, it doesn't. I mean, it creates wealth for the very, very rich, but that's about it. It certainly doesn't trickle down. It kills it destroys the economy below that. And number one. And number two, this whole idea of globalization, which is still being embraced by liberals and progressives, oddly enough, that we should simply throw open our doors to the whole entire world, and American workers should compete with people in Africa who are making literally $2 a day, and people who are in China, or a year rather, a day. In China, where you've got people who are making $4 or $5 a day, in Mexico, where you've got people making $10, $12 a day, that we should be competing with them. And it just makes no sense. It's not how we built this country. It's not how other countries are doing it. I watched Bush's speech from Peru, from Lima, Peru, on the cruise ship. We had CNN. And I wanted to watch that speech. And Bush gets up there and he says, free trade is what made Japan and South Korea prosperous. I'm telling you, South Korea's major export, before they put up import tariffs and before they started protecting their economy, their major export was human hair. The average income in South Korea was under $500 a year. Similarly, the major export in Japan before they started putting up tariffs was silk. He is so wrong.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, if you're thinking of voting for Saxby Chambliss, the guy who, in my opinion, stole the election in 2000 when the state of Georgia, the guy who beat, end quote, Max Cleland by running an ad that had pictures of Osama bin Laden in it. Max Cleland, the vet who lost three limbs, one arm and two legs in Vietnam. And Saxby Chambliss, the draft dodger, who ran against him and called him unpatriotic in the 2002 election, or implied that he was said he wasn't sufficiently supportive of George W. Bush, and implied he was unpatriotic. Turns out Chambliss, it even gets weirder. Chambliss has hosted a golf event at a whites-only country club. Amazing. Amazing. Carrie Lucas is with us. She is the Vice President for Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org, a conservative group for women who want to hang out with other conservative women. Is that a good way to say it, Carrie, or would you characterize yourself?
Oh, sure. That's a fantastic way. Although we welcome all comers. Any liberal women out there who want to give some different ideas a try, we welcome them, too.
Great. So liberals can join, too. Super. You may have some very interesting conversations coming up, Carrie.
Carrie is with IWF.org is the website. And you've written an article, If the Obama Kids Get School's Choice, Shouldn't Everyone? And, you know, at the level of being able to put your kids in a private school, I mean, we have three children. Our oldest went to public schools all the way through. Our middle child went to public schools up until high school, and he went to a private high school. And our youngest went to public schools up until junior high school, and we homeschooled her for junior high and high school. And she actually didn't do the last year or maybe 2 years of high school, went directly into college. And so it seems like there's plenty of choice out there for people who have enough money to pick choice. Is, you know, what are you suggesting is wrong with what the Obamas have done, or how do you think our system should be changed? Do you think everybody should be able to send their child to a $30,000 a year school like Sidwell?
Well, you know, if only. I mean, that's obviously, it's a shame that of course there is scarcity and there aren't enough spots at slots, fantastic places like Sidwell where the Obama children are going to be going. And I, of course, I think it's fantastic. If I was in the Obama's shoes, I would be doing the exact same thing and trying to get my girls the best education possible. But what disturbs me and what I think people should start talking about is about the opportunities and the lack thereof that are for low-income children, because right now we do have school choice for some. You can choose a private school, or the way that most people exercise school choice is where they decide to live. Most Americans, when they're picking out the community they want to either rent or own a home in, they think about the school quality. But unfortunately for people with really low incomes, they have no options. They can't change where they live, and so they're stuck with their local public school. You know, increasingly, policymakers across the board, and a lot of Democrats are starting to realize that this really isn't fair, and that we recognize that one size fits all doesn't work very often, and it certainly doesn't work when it comes to education, and are looking at new ways to give people school choice. But unfortunately, Senator Obama has thus far said that he opposes the D.C. voucher plan, which is giving vouchers to 1,900 kids, poor kids in the nation's capital that has some of the worst public schools in the country, schools that he wouldn't send his girls to, and they're planning on shutting down that program, and I think that's a real shame, and I think D.C. parents need to be aware of that, and people around the country need to say, hey, wait a minute, we should do better by all kids.
Well, let's look at this for a moment, Carrie Lucas. I agree with you that parents should have the choice of schools to send their kids to. And if this is what you're saying, that regardless of their income, parents should have the choice of schools to send their kids to, by and large, I agree with that, too. So the problem with the voucher programs that I've seen, and I have some insight into this, not only just having raised three kids, I also have written seven books on education. I've done training for school districts from Atlanta to Detroit to Los Angeles to, you know, I don't know if it's hundreds, but certainly at least 100 schools, school districts around the United States, as well as I've trained school districts in Singapore, in the United Kingdom. You know, I was very involved in the education field throughout the 90s. And as a consultant, and for up until this year, for 30 years, I've been chairman of the board of directors of a private school. Hunterschool.org is the website, a school for kids with learning disabilities, which is a rather expensive school, by the way, because it takes kids who are really seriously challenged, mostly with ADHD. And although it's not for profit, I've never made a penny off that school. In fact, I make a donation every year to it, so it's a net loss for me. But the point is that we have schools in the United States. Sidwell costs, I think, $38,000 a year. The average cost of public school in the United States is around $6,000 a year, although there are some school districts that are actually able to provide an education for as little as $4,000 and others that spend around $10,000 or $12,000. The problem that I have with vouchers is that vouchers are typically for $2,000 or $3,000, which means that if you have a high enough income that you can afford to send your kid to Sidwell, you just got a $2,000 or $3,000 discount off Sidwell. But if you're, a poor person, that $2,000 or $3,000, there's no school in Washington, D.C. that's going to take a $2,000 or $3,000 voucher.
Sure, absolutely. And I would have a problem with that system as well. But that's not, when we look at specifically what's going on in D.C., the vouchers, I believe, are around $7,000 or $8,000. And I would be totally welcome. Right now, D.C. spending, the D.C. public schools receive between $12,000 and $13,000 per pupil. And I know that isn't inclusive of all the costs associated with public education,
yeah,
but they are spending a ton of money. It's the second highest per pupil expenditure in the country, and they're just absolutely dismal schools. So, you know, in my book, I'd say, hey, that money should follow the child, and bad public schools should close down, and we should rethink this entirely, because you're right, $2,000 isn't going to do enough for low-income kids.
What you want to do, Carrie, is you want to set up a competition between not-for-profit public schools, state-owned public schools, state-run public schools, and not-for-profit or for-profit private schools. And the problem that I see with that is that you're going to your public schools, and I've seen this happen in many places. I saw it in particular with the Atlanta public schools, is that your public schools end up as dumping grounds for people who can't afford, even with a voucher, can't afford the private schools. Why not do something like Holland does? Holland says, we will fund any school. We'll fund Catholic schools. We'll fund Muslim schools. We'll fund Hindu schools. We'll fund secular schools. We'll fund Quaker schools. We'll fund any school, and we'll fund them in ways that are sufficiently reasonable that they can actually function by and large without the parents having to pay for it. The only thing is that those schools have to have certain minimal educational criteria, including teaching the values of the country, and including, for example, in Holland, you have to, you know, by the time you graduate from high school, you have to speak four languages. I mean, certain basic stuff. Why not simply say that, and that all of those schools are considered part of the public education system? Their parents are members of the teachers union, their teachers are members of the teachers union. They are answerable to the government, which is answerable to the people. What's wrong with that?
Well, you see, I think that a lot of what you're saying makes sense, but I wouldn't want to just turn our basically nationalize or make the government in charge of our private school system. They need to have the freedom to choose curriculums and to specialize and to use different techniques. You know, it would worry me, frankly, if you forced all of the teachers that are currently in private schools into the teachers' unions. That could create a lot of problems, because I think the root cause of a lot of the problems in the United States today are the teachers' unions, which right now really see the school system as a jobs program for adults. They don't care about the education quality, or many of them don't care.
This is where we get to the
care about the education program.
Yeah, this is where we get to what I think is the core of the argument, the conservative argument against public schools, and that is that the employees are unionized. And I know that there's never been a union that a conservative ever liked.
That's not true, Tom, because, you know, I respect if there's good teachers want to be in a union and they're welcoming competition from others, I think that's fine. But right now,
do you know, Carrie, anybody who ever went into education for the money?
Pardon me?
Do you know anybody who ever went into education for the big bucks?
I know a lot of people who went into education for the hours and for the job security. And I know, you know, I went to a public school. And
well, what's wrong with job security?
There was a lot of absolutely terrible teachers out there who sat there, and, you know, there would be people would come out and say, "Boy, we really need to get rid of this person because they're awful." But there was that teacher is still sitting there today, not teaching students, because it is almost impossible to get rid of a teacher because of the union rules, no matter how bad they are, no matter how much they disturb their
Carrie, students. I'm sorry. I have worked in schools. If there's a consensus within a school that a teacher is a lousy teacher, even though there's a union, the other teacher, they'll get rid of that person, or they'll get that.
No, they won't, Tom. That is absolutely untrue. There are absolute rules that forbid and prevent. Most teachers can sit there until for the cow to come home, and I can talk about some in Weston, Connecticut, where I went to school.
Yeah. Okay. So the bottom line for you is bust the union.
Well, no, it's out of competition. If the unions are so good, and if it's really all quality teachers, then they should have no problem competing against the private sector.
Okay. Carrie,
this is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour in the Tom Hartman radio program. brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our show, supporting your radio station, the station you're listening on, and supporting our advertisers. Call them up, let them know you're listening, let them know if you like the show, and with the advertisers, let them know you're going to buy their products, or if you don't have the need for whatever it may be, fill in the blank, that you'll tell your friends, that you'll recommend them. Thank them for advertising with us. Thank them for carrying our show. Let them know you're listening. 22 minutes past the hour. There is no link. You can find this information, by the way, complete with studies, rather exhaustive studies linked to it, from the National Education Association, the Teachers Union's website, NEA.org. Fact, no link between vouchers and gains in student achievement. None. None whatsoever. They don't expand choices for parents. They've got studies from Milwaukee, from Cleveland, from Florida, in detail, I mean, and a number of others. And I'm not going to get into all the details on this, but bottom line, the most dramatic improvements in student achievements have occurred in places where vouchers do not exist, such as Texas, North Carolina, Connecticut, and Chicago. Why? Those states and communities focus on teacher quality and extra help for students who need it. This is not rocket science. Number two, to use a terribly overused cliche, number two, vouchers undermine accountability for public funds. The absence of public accountability for voucher funds has contributed to rampant fraud, waste, and abuse in current voucher programs. In fact, you've got people who are setting up schools just to make a buck on it. Nobody should be making a buck in education. Education is part of the commons. Education is our most important investment in the future, in our children. Number three, vouchers do not reduce public education costs. In fact, the opposite. They increase public education costs because they create two parallel school systems, one public, one private, that are competing at, you know, Sidwell arguably is not competing with private schools because those parents with that much wealth would not be sending their kids to private schools no matter what. They may be sending them off to a Swiss boarding school otherwise, as they used to do back in the 50s. So that's not the problem. But when you have vouchers, you create a private and public school that are competing for the public school kids. And what happens is that the private schools pick and choose the kids they'll take. And so they siphon off the cream of the crop, as it were, in terms of academic and behavioral positives, and leave the schools with those kids who have the academic and behavioral negatives, and further ghettoize public schools. They don't reduce the cost of education to public schools. In fact, they increase it because now you've got more and more kids who are requiring Title I funding and other types of funding to provide for learning disabilities and serious learning problems. All that stuff gets dumped on the public schools, and it further deteriorates the public schools. Number four, they do not give parents real educational choices. Unlike public schools, private and religious schools can, and by the way, they do, discriminate in admissions on the basis of prior academic achievement, standardized test scores, interviews with applicants. They discriminate on the basis of gender. They discriminate legally on the basis of religion. They discriminate on the basis of income, on the basis of special needs, and on behavioral histories. Whereas public schools are, by law, not allowed to discriminate on any of these bases. So once again, they end up with the kids who are left over, which is far more expensive. And then you say, well, gee, public school can educate these kids for $8,000. Why can't a public school do it? Because the public schools are dealing with the least of the least, the hardest, the most difficult to educate. And finally, the public disapproves of vouchers. You know, just right across the board, 13 different states have had, since 1966, have had citizen initiatives put on the ballot for vouchers, and 22 times in the District of Columbia, and with the lone exception of South Dakota, which approved a provision for textbooks for parochial schools in 1986, vouchers have been rejected as public aid to private and religious schools every single time. And in fact, on average, in those 22 elections, two out of three times, 66% of the time on average, two out of three times, the voters said no. They cast no votes. So this is just, in my humble opinion, a bad idea. We do need to be doing a lot to improve the quality of public education. A lot. But tearing apart teachers' unions and saying to the kids who are in public schools, sorry, Charlie, you're going to public school and you're just, you know, we're going to have to take some of those resources and deal with the most difficult problematic children, because Because all the kids who might be able to peer teach you, who might be able to help you, who might be actually able to reduce the overall cost of public schools because they're not constantly demanding extra attention. The kids who make it possible to have 20 kids in a classroom or 30 kids in a classroom, which frankly I think is too many, as opposed to 5 or 10 because you've got so many special needs kids, those kids have gone off to a private school. And so the public school is having to deal just or largely with the really problematic children. And thus what happens? They get a bad reputation. They get a bad name. Everybody figures that out. And you see this writ large in Washington, D.C., where the relatively wealthy people who work in government, and not rich, but, you know, the top end of the group, and the senators, the congressmen, the White House aides, all these, they're all sending their kids to private schools. And if all of them were sending their kids to public schools, if you had the diversity in public schools that is represented by the diversity of the population, and I realize it's still largely an African-American city, but nonetheless, the diversity of population that exists in Washington, D.C., I'm telling you, the public schools would be a hell of a lot better. It has to do with the kids as well as the teachers.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Unbalanced. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 35 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com for our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for our free stream, our video stream, Hal in Michigan. Hey, Al, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom Hartman.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for the opportunity to participate in your program here. Yeah, I heard you say something about wrote a couple books in education. And
yeah, I have.
Maybe you could give me the name of the books I could get.
The two best of the seven that I've written in that field, the very first one I wrote back in 1991, it's called ADD, Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. And the most recent one, which came out 2 years ago, is called The Edison Gene. And those two books,
Tom,
and thank you for asking. Now, those two books, I think.
Yeah, Tom, you know, you I've been listening to you for a long time. I had a brain tumor, and I can't watch television or a computer screen much, so I do a lot of listening, and I listen to you guys' program all the time, and that is a real gift for me.
Well, thank
you. And I heard you speak earlier that you spoke a little bit German.
Nur ein bisschen Deutsch, kann ich sprechen. I never studied German in school. I lived in Germany for a year, and so I picked it up, and it's the worst kind of street German. Yeah.
We are Germans, and then we ended up in Yugoslavia and in Croatia.
Oh, my.
And then in Croatia, we ended up in concentration camp in Hungary, Russian concentration camp. And so I went to various schools, and I went to school in Austria most of my time until we came to America. So my tongue's all twisted. So.
I can imagine. Al, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. And,
okay.
You know, it's great to hear German. It's funny. My very first language actually was Yiddish. It was the first language I spoke, but very, very shortly after I spoke German, or English, rather. But I think as a result of that, you know, your first languages get burned into the deepest recesses of your brain. And so as a result of that, my Hebrew is pretty decent, you know, at least my pronunciation, you know, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam, and I can do the ha, and challah. give me some of the challah. And my German is pretty decent, and you know, but my vocabulary in both cases is pretty limited, and my Japanese is pretty terrible now. My daughter and I took a course in Japanese years ago. I used to do a lot of business in Japanese. Arigato gozaimashita. Bob in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm from the government, and I'm here to help. Ever since Reagan uttered those words, the whole intent of the Republican Party has to make government not work so that they can privatize. And I think,
In fact, here's what Limbaugh had to say about it.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
So there you go.
Well, Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think a good example of how efficient the government is, and we've recently seen it in Iraq, and that is Blackwater, which is an illegal parallel military organization, which is draining off dollars from our military and being used for private army. And Tom, they have definition is very important. They have changed the definitions. It used to be, I'm sure you're old enough to remember, the spoil system. And then we went to the civil service system.
Right.
Well, now they've changed the wording. We're going back to the spoil system, but it's called privatization.
You're absolutely
and it's
right.
It's doling out public dollars to private individuals. And in every instance, and you can see it where we're at now with the economy, in every instance, the people at the top, when we privatize, make a lot of money, and the salaries and the income for everyone else goes down, and that money gets drained out of communities because the people at the top don't live in the communities and spend their money there. They invest it anywhere in the world.
That's absolutely right, Bob, and very well said. Thank you for saying it. And one of these days I'm going to do an economic rant about why CEOs are making the decisions they are, why and how they're paid the way they are, and how we can change that. But right now I'd like to stay with teachers. Victor in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Victor, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm doing okay. I really appreciated that discussion concerning vouchers and privatizing school system. I'm from Dayton, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know, it's one of the largest mid-sized cities.
Yep. Victor, are you still there, Victor?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, for a minute there, I had a very strange logo showing up on the caller screen board, and you vanished. So, anyhow, you were saying, you're from Dayton, Ohio.
Right. I'm from an area that had one of the largest number of chartered, privatized schools for profit. And, man, I tell you, we were bombarded. Now, I'm a father. I have 8 children. We were bombarded with advertisement about these schools. It was all for profit, no government oversight. And one of the arguments about how bad public schools were, and granted, public schools need a whole lot of attention.
Yep.
But one of the things is, of course, what you talked about is how much money it was used to educate those that were in the inner city, poor areas, mainly African American, where I was from. And never in that formula do they include the amount of money needed for those coming without. I mean, as the system to help create a safety net was taken away in order to educate anybody coming from a rough environment, you had to add it to the school system.
Right. Yeah.
And it was pathetic, man. I mean, I just appreciate any chance there is to attack what these people have done. Every time government is effective, like the Postal Service, they steal it. They steal our money and they steal
absolutely
the
right.
services.
That's, you know, it's the shock doctrine. It's Naomi Klein identifies it so clearly, and it is the kleptocracy. Well said, Victor. Thank you very much for the call. I absolutely right. Absolutely right. Debbie in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Debbie.
Hi, Tom. My husband and I were having a conversation about when the schools went from 20 kids to 30 kids.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it being in the 80s when my kids were little, and I'm from Portland, and one of the things I noticed about schools in Portland, Portland public schools, is that they just threw away the at-risk kids.
How?
They didn't have time for them. I remember when I was in school, we had detention, We had, you know, people who tried to help you.
Right.
And nowadays in the school system, they just say, you're not coming.
Well, if parents have, you know, the fact of the matter is that's illegal. I mean, you've got children are entitled by law to a comprehensive and effective public education. And if a school district can't deal with those kids, then they are required by law, and there's no shortage of lawyers who will litigate this stuff. They are required by law the school district is required to pay to send that child to a school that will take good care of them. And I know that because I was the founder of and on the board for many years of just such a school, the Hunter School, as in Hunter to Farmer's World. HunterSchool.org is the website, and it's a school for kids with ADHD. And probably 3/4 of the kids in our program are kids that came from referring school districts. And they did so very reluctantly because it costs a lot more to send them to our program than to keep them in-house and just warehouse them. But it's against the law to warehouse them. So if you know, Debbie, of kids who are being warehoused in schools or who are not getting services, tell those parents to find an educational advocate or a lawyer and take on the district. Because, you know, it happens rarely, and it shouldn't happen at all. Bob in New York City. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Just great. What's up?
Well, I wanted to comment on your conversation with Carrie Lucas. I used to work for the Board of Education. I have 3 children who went to public school, and, you know, there are good schools in the New York City school system, and there's schools that are not so good. But the problem is not the unions. The problem is that the school system is chronically underfunded, and they are operating the way anyone on a starvation diet for years and years would operate there. You know, it's almost like a triage of education. And, you know, the unions have been a battlefront against, you know, increasing class sizes and overloading teachers with disciplinary actions because they just can't control that size of student
Absolutely.
Population.
In my experience and in my opinion, the unions are working in the best interest of the kids as well as the teachers, because you can't have the interest of the teachers served without the kids being successful. Well said, Bob. Thank you very much. Tom in Seattle. Hey, Tom. Quick one?
Yes. Yeah, Tom. I'm just confirming your views on education. I'm a professor at 3 different universities out here. And basically, if we looked at scores of youngsters over the last 20 years, actually, high school kids are smarter today than they were 20 years ago. All the SAT scores, when tabulated, all come out that way. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So this notion that schools are getting worse is actually not the case. So,
well, that's interesting. Good news.
Secondly, pardon me?
Good news. Real quick.
Yeah, real quick, unions come to us in schools and say, please help us get rid of poor teachers. Principals, please do your paperwork. We are there to support you.
Yeah.
And so that the notion that unions protect good teachers is not the case, at least in Washington and Oregon.
Yeah, no, I've personally seen cases where unions work to get bad teachers out. That's the reality. 46 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Radio for the sane among us, the few, the sane, the in charge of the country now. Welcome back. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. The website talkradionews.com is on the line with us with a report today from Washington, D.C. Victoria, the accredited White House reporter, Pentagon reporter, UN reporter, and congressional reporter. And what am I missing, Victoria?
Well, of course, we've got the Citigroup bailout, and of course, we have Barack Obama's press conference, so you're not missing any of that, I'm sure. You're on top of it.
No, I meant what missing in terms of all the various credentials you have.
Oh, what are you missing? Oh, Safeway reporter.
Oh, okay. All right, accredited Safeway reporter. So, no, but you can recap those stories, because they have not been at the core of my show today. You know, we've been talking about the economic bailout in our first hour and talking about teachers and and public schools and school vouchers in our second hour. So feel free to give us a recap of the whole day's news, please.
Well, very briefly, late last night, like midnight last night, U.S. government regulators approved what's being described as a radical plan to stabilize Citigroup in an interesting arrangement. What they're going to do is the government's going to back about $306 billion in loans and securities and then directly invest about $20 billion in the company. That's the simple version. It's much more complicated than that, but that's the very basic version. As they will also take partial ownership of the company. Well, they'll buy shares in the company. They'll get shares as a result of this. Now, one thing that will please a lot of people, including some of your listeners, I would think, Citigroup will agree to certain executive compensation restrictions as part of this plan.
Now, here's what I don't get, Victoria. The Fed has already publicly announced, this was as of about 2 weeks ago, that they have given $2,000 billion to various financial institutions, much of it in the form of loans, but nonetheless, that they've already passed out over $2 trillion. None of it required an act of Congress because the Fed can simply open their loan window and pass out the money. The Secretary of Treasury, the Treasury Department, has passed out a little over $300 billion. Got another $300 billion to go. On top of this, there are other just government expenditures and things that keep things going. I mean, keep in mind, for example, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney were appointed as president and vice president by the Supreme Court, Halliburton was within 6 months of bankruptcy. They were not doing well. Halliburton is now a huge and prosperous company that is no longer even an American company. They're now based in the Middle East. According to Bloomberg this morning, the U.S. I'll just read the first sentence. The U.S. government is prepared to lend more than $7.4 trillion. On behalf of American taxpayers. Now, $7.4 trillion, if we have 115,000 or 125 million workers, working families in the United States, right? You divide $7.4 billion by 125 million, and you get somewhere in the neighborhood of the high $60,000. In other words, if they took that $7.4 trillion and said, you know, you really want to stimulate the economy? What we're going to do is make sure that every wage earner in the United States is earning at least $60,000 a year by increasing the minimum wage, even if the government has to subsidize it, or supporting those companies that pay minimum wage, or having unions, or even just writing a check to everybody in America for $60,000. You want to see stimulation. Boy, would you see stimulation, although the danger of that is, of course, it would create a bubble. But why not do it systemically? Why are we giving $60,000 for every American worker to bankers and corporate CEOs who fly around in private jets rather than to people who can't afford to pay off their student loans, people who can't afford to get into good schools, people who can't afford to buy groceries at the supermarket they're having to live on dog food, people who can't afford their medication, people whose homes are in foreclosure? What the hell is going on in this country, Victoria?
That's a question I'm not qualified to answer. But it's an extraordinary amount of money. It really is. And it's a lot of it is coming from foreign sources, and it's money that we're going to have to pay back with interest.
Yeah. Well, that's where the gotcha goes. And, oh, well, actually, the money that the Fed is passing out doesn't have to be paid back. I mean, theoretically, if the Fed loans $1 trillion and never gets paid back, they simply increase the money supply by $1 trillion. They simply manufacture the money out of thin air. It decreases the value of all the other dollars in circulation, and we have what's called inflation. So,
To the deflation, which we seem to be moving towards right now.
Yeah, this is the big question, the big battle is, are we going into a deflationary spiral, otherwise known as a Great Depression, or are we going into an inflationary spiral, or otherwise known as hyperinflation? And there's a lot of people who are saying you can flip a coin. You know, it's nobody's sure. So anyway, they're going to bail out Citibank.
They're going to bail out Citigroup. It's basically considered too big to fail. The biggest bank in the world, and so that's what they're going to do. And,
you know, the ultimate irony of this.
Nobody's head rolls.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
The ultimate irony of their bailing out Citigroup is that Citibank had, back in the day, they had a CEO who wrote a book, and I'm trying to remember his name in the book, and it's not immediately coming to me. But anyhow, he wrote this book in which he talked about the end of regulated markets and how, you know, we're all Alan Greenspan, we're all Ayn Rand now, and, you know, how the banks, they no longer needed to be regulated at all, that they could regulate themselves, and, you know, we should offshore labor and back office functions and all this stuff. And this is in the 1980s, and he was hailed as a visionary genius. And now his company is in the toilet.
It is fascinating the way things turn out.
It is.
It is fascinating. Well, the other big news today, of course, was that Barack Obama held his second news conference and announced the key players of his economic team. Tim Geithner will be the Treasury Secretary, currently President of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And Lawrence Summers, former Treasury Secretary under the Clinton administration, will be head of the Economic Council inside the White House. Christina Romer, currently an economics professor at Berkeley, will be chair of the Council of Economic Advisers. And Melody Barnes will be the director of the Domestic Policy Council.
Hmm. And what's your sense of the quality of that list?
It's considered to be a pretty strong list. Christina Romer, considered one of the best economists, and Melody Barnes comes with high marks as well.
That's great. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com, the website. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Your money and your life? How do women avoid becoming bag ladies? Or is it really not all that bad? And what's the status of pay for women versus men in this society and for women of color versus men of color? The high stakes for women voters in 08 and beyond is the subtitle of Martha Burke's new book, Your Money and Your Life. She is the money editor for Ms. Magazine. And the author of this new book, you can find her writings online at msmagazine.com, msmagazine.com. Martha Burke, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Good to be here.
Great to have you with us. You are also the author of The Cult of Power, which that's a thought provoker, a provocative title.
Oh, that's about your big corporate boys.
Yeah, I see. So the question, you know, let me just ask some of the questions that are at the core of each of your titles. What is at stake here in Your Money and Your Life?
Well, it's interesting because the book came out before the election, and it's a book on policy about what we've lost as women policy-wise vis-a-vis the United States government in the last 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of what we have to gain now that the election is over, if the new president and Congress will pay attention to some of the things that are going on. You know, right now, of course, the economy is everybody's number one issue. But the economy affects women very differently than it affects men. And not just because we're still making 77 cents on the dollar, although that is true, but because we suffer from, experiencing, shall I say, the legacy of some government policies that go back as far as the last Great Depression that have not changed very much for women, and it's taken a toll in a downturn.
Let's get to those in just a second, but first, the first point that you made, I'm fascinated by. It seems that employers, in a downturn where they're stripping jobs, we had over 500,000 people apply for unemployment benefits last month, something we haven't seen in a long, long time. If you calculate unemployment the same way they did when Bill Clinton came into office, because he made some major changes in the way that unemployment is calculated, which made it look like a lot fewer people were unemployed than actually were. If you calculated it the way that it was calculated before he came into office, we would have an unemployment rate now of at least 11 and arguably 13%. I mean, it would be very, very significant. So as companies are shedding jobs, it seems to me just logically, I have absolutely no factual data to back this up, and I'm guessing that you do, or to refute it for that matter, it seems logically that a company would be laying off, and I've certainly seen that in some companies that I'm close to, they lay off the most highly paid people first, and keep on the more poorly paid people, which would mean that if women are making less than men, that they'd be less likely to be fired or laid off.
Well, that's actually what we're finding in this particular downturn, but I don't think your reason for it is exactly on point. What we're finding is that women are concentrated in low-wage jobs to begin with and a few jobs that are still expanding like health care. Mm-hmm. But it's low-level jobs like health aid and the sort of thing that's minimum wage or barely above. So that sector actually, according to the Labor Department just last week, is still expanding a little bit.
Right.
And if
Walmart's showing profits right now.
Yeah, and Walmart is heavily female. 68% of its workers are female, again, because it's low-wage work. Now, where the layoffs are coming, it's rippling through from the housing meltdown. That's construction. That's some good union jobs. That's some good construction and infrastructure jobs, and those are heavily male.
Yeah.
So what we're finding, unlike the 2001 recession, where women, if you will, caught up with men in the number of layoffs. So far, this is a men's recession more than a women's recession.
But in that 2001 layoff, wasn't that mostly because there are so many flight attendants in the United States?
Well, that was part of it, yeah. And Carolyn Maloney, Democrat of New York, actually did a study on whether women were suffering as much as men in that downturn, and they actually were.
Yeah.
Now, this time it's different, but it is still affecting women negatively for this reason, Tom. You know, Congress just passed a few days ago an extension of unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because folks that are running out of benefits and were coming up on the holidays and they wanted to, you know, do something for them.
Right. They pushed it out 13 weeks, as I recall.
Yeah. But what's wrong with that for women is that a lot of women are not covered in the first place. Because that system was crafted in the 1930s, during the Great Depression. It was crafted for families with one worker, a husband back in those days, full-time worker, who was laid off for a reason beyond his control. So it doesn't cover part-time. There are a lot of women that are part-time. You have to meet a certain earnings threshold to be covered by unemployment. A lot of women don't meet that. And then when you combine it with some of our very pathetic social policies that keep women out of the full-time workforce, such as lack of child care, you have got a lot of women working two part-time jobs, neither of which are covered by the unemployment system. So extending the system is good for those that qualify, but let's not forget that a lot of folks, most of them female, don't qualify in the first place.
Yeah. So the Great Depression? By the way, on this show, we don't refer to it as the Great Depression. We refer to it as the Republican Great Depression.
Oh, all right. I'm cool with that.
So in any case, is unemployment the Depression-era program that you were talking about that's not really helping women out?
Well, I wouldn't say it's not helping women, but
or not to the extent that it should.
Missing a lot of women.
Yeah. So what do we do? Reform unemployment and just say, hey, if you ever had any job of any amount, you get an unemployment check that's proportionate to that?
Well, yeah, you can prorate it, and a lot of members of Congress want to do that. They want it to cover part-time on a prorated basis, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And many employers object to that.
Right.
Because it costs them money, you know, every month to pay into the system.
Right.
So you're fighting corporate America on it, just like on most other things.
Back in March, we did our show, maybe it was June. I think in March we went to Darfur, and we did our show from Denmark for a week. Danish radio.
I heard some of it.
Oh, well, great. Danish radio was kind enough to give us a studio, and talking with legislators and average folks and the number two person in the country, it's not called vice president, but nonetheless, if a woman gets pregnant in Denmark, not only does she get, as I recall, a year and a half, maybe it was 2 years of paid maternity leave, but her husband does as well. It's a little bit less time, but and they can flip it if they want. I mean, you know, one of them gets like 2 years, the other gets a year or something like that, and it's just this is the deal. And employers, and you know, I had a caller from America who was asking, as I recall, it was Sophie Hetschorp, one of the legislators, who was calling and said, but doesn't this put employers out of work? And she said, no, employers plan for this right from the get-go, and because it applies to men as well as women, it doesn't cause discrimination against women in the workplace. And we figure if you can't conduct your business in such a way that you can make a profit and you can have enough of a reserve so that when people get pregnant and they have daycare, child leave and or daycare, as by the way, as well, then you have no right doing business in our country. Can we expect that sort of mentality to catch up here in the United States?
Oh, God, maybe in the 3000th century. I don't know.
You're not that hopeful about this new administration?
I am hopeful that the new administration can do some things legally, Tom. Absolutely, I'm hopeful about that. Attitude-wise, though, it takes a lot longer.
Yeah.
And as long as our government is under the thumb of corporate America, and I believe it is, we're going to have to fight every little change like this. My mental image is just like we are in the trenches and these folks are coming down on us.
We're talking with
the Bush administration just last week weakened our very poor unpaid family leave system as it is.
Yeah.
And they made it easier for employers to deny it.
Right. They're chopping away at everything they can. Martha Burke, she's the author of Your Money and Your Life, The High Stakes for Women Voters in 08 and Beyond. She's also an editor at Ms. Magazine, msmagazine.com. Martha, thanks for dropping by today.
Hey, thank you.
Great talking with you. Great book. I highly recommend it. It is 17 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270. Back with your calls and more right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Of our lives might involve once in a while having to get some health care. Might be a good idea. 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. And Dennis Rivera is with us. He is the chair of the SEIU health care programs. Their website, of course, SEIU.org. And Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what are the, in your opinion, what are the options, what are the best options that the administration should be considering, and what are the most likely options that this administration will be pursuing?
Well, the reality is, first of all, thank you for having me on your show. The reality is that at this moment, the healthcare system in the United States is completely broken, and it's one of the reasons why the American economy is in such a difficult shape. 80% of all the bankruptcies in America are related to people who cannot afford their health care coverage.
80%? I had heard 50%. I didn't realize it had grown to that.
Yes. It's a very dramatic number. It's basically from folks who basically have their own health insurance, and then they get hit by a car. Their health care coverage is up to $1 million. They hit that ceiling, and at that point they start getting hit with all kinds of bills, and then the next thing that happens, you have, in order to protect your whatever you have, you just file for bankruptcy. So that's a reality.
Wow.
On the other hand, as we speak right now, we're close to about 50 million Americans who don't have health care coverage, and that number, it's dramatically increasing, particularly in this time of economic crisis. So we need to deal with the health, with our broken healthcare system. So as we speak right now, we in SEIU and many others across the United States are working incredibly hard to make sure that we, in the first 100 to 120 days of the Obama administration, we pass a healthcare reform that would guarantee healthcare coverage to everybody in this country, and at the same time that will guarantee that the healthcare costs do not keep soaring at the way they're doing right now.
Along with healthcare costs soaring, our healthcare profits soaring. We have for-profit healthcare in the United States, And these companies are making a fortune. I mean, 2 years ago when Bill McGuire retired from United Healthcare, the company that offers insurance through AARP, he took a $1.7 billion paycheck.
I agree with you. It's completely outrageous. And one of the problems we have is precisely that, you know, the amount of the monies that you pay in premiums and how much of that money goes for healthcare coverage. But I believe that that's why we need a comprehensive healthcare reform.
What does that look like for you, Dennis Rivera?
Well, for basically will mean that, first of all, that everybody should get access to healthcare. That's first and foremost. Two, that we have the responsibility, namely employers, the government, and individuals, to make sure that we have a healthcare coverage that works for all of us. That nobody can be denied access to healthcare because of their pre-existing condition. That if you have a healthcare coverage and you move from one job to the next, you can move. That goes with you. So you're not job lock, you know, which is right. That you cannot move on. It means that you have a healthcare coverage that is affordable, that you can pay for it, that a healthcare benefit that is meaningful, that namely that is like the healthcare coverage that the members of Congress has, the federal benefit package.
What they have basically is the ability to buy health insurance, and the government picks up the tab for it. I know Bernie Sanders, a regular on the show, has Blue Cross Blue Shield. And you know, so you can pick from a couple of different, you know, the top end of them, but from a couple of different commercially offered plans. What's wrong with going back to the way it was in the United States in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, where virtually every state in the union required that any health insurance company in that state, operating in that state, had to be a not-for-profit corporation, so that their first job, their first motivation was not to generate a profit, but was to actually provide health care? And or what's wrong with going to a single-payer system, to simply saying everybody in the United States is now covered by Medicare?
Well, first of all, we, I mean the extended big family of SEIU, we are in the same page, Tom, that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. We would love to have a single-payer system with Medicare for all, et cetera, et cetera. The problem that we have is that we have been at this for 100 years, trying to get universal health care coverage in the United States. And what we're trying to do is to make it happen. And in that context, I don't think that at this very same moment, I don't think that we can make happen a bill for a single-payer system in our country if, you know, that's what we want. But,
yeah, you know, I had a conversation with John Edwards about this back when he was still a contender for president. And his plan, which has largely become, to a large extent, has become the Obama plan, his plan suggested that pretty much anybody could buy into Medicare. And I said, I'm doing this from memory, and it's been well over a year, so my words may not be exact, but I said basically, wouldn't so many people buy in that it would put the private insurance companies out of business? And he said, yeah, that's the idea. So, you know, it seems like a good start. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the break coming up, so we're out of time here.
Thank you so much for having me in your show. Look forward to being there. Many more times. Thank you.
SEIU.org is the website. Dennis Rivera. Dennis, thank you so much. 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. You can go to teamster.org for more information. Here on the True People's Radio.
Ghost chickens in the sky.
It's our pigeon alert. They're sort of pigeons. You know. We don't actually have pigeon music for our pigeon alerts because pigeons, of course, are robots, and so the recorded noises they make are, don't show up very well on recording devices. They have ways of canceling them out. Retired nurse Cynthia O'Neill, 70, from Burgess Hill, UK, visited Worthington's Beach House Park after Remembrance Sunday. That was 11-11. For the past 2 years, to pay tribute to the Pigeon Memorial. The landscape memorial was built in 1949 and honors pigeons who died in the Second World War. She left a handwritten tribute to the birds this year, adorned with poppies and waterproofed and cling film, which read, "Pigeons forced to man's wars, thank you." She said she was disappointed hers was the only such tribute on display and urged people to remember the important role played by pigeons in the wars. Well, the reason hers was the only tribute on display is because most people realize that pigeons are robots from the planet Xenu sent here to spy on us. And I don't know how the Allied forces, maybe they reprogrammed them. Maybe they put new chips in their little brains. Because wherever there's, you know, important things going on in the world, what do you have? Pigeons. You never see dead pigeons. You never see baby pigeons. They're robots. 36 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, Max in Seattle. Hey, Max, what's on your mind today?
I'm still back on the topic of education.
Sure.
It seems to be that back in the early 1900s, we started making education into an assembly line where the school system is creating winners and losers. And we're still doing that. And there's really no need for it. And it just creates a... You could not design a better system for keeping our prisons full, that's for sure.
Horace Mann, who is considered
the... point.
Yeah, well said. Thank you very much, Max. Horace Mann, who is considered the father of modern education, in the 1880s, he went over to England, or to Germany, rather, and got this new invention. I mean, it was literally invented in Germany. In the 1860s, 1870s, it was called the PhD, the professor, the doctorate of philosophy. And for $500, you could go to Germany, and it took about 6 months, and you could get your PhD and come back to the United States and call yourself doctor. And he did that, and he was very impressed by the German school system. And the German school system was actually largely founded in Austria in the late 1700s by Queen Marie Theresa, as I recall. I'm doing this all from memory, so I may be a little off on names or dates, but I don't think so. I wrote about this in my book, Tom Hartman's Complete Guide to ADHD. There's a whole chapter on the history of modern public education. And she started what were called the Spinnenschulen, which is the spinning schools. And the deal was, she said to poor families, if you want your children to learn to read and write, send them to us. And for half a day, we will teach them how to read and write. And the other half of the day, they will pay for their education by spinning cloth and thread and making cloth. Thus, Spinnenschulen, the spinning schools. And that morphed into what ultimately became the German public education system. So when Horace Mann came back to the United States in the late 1800s, he ran around trying to get everybody to pick up the German school of German school model of education. And he said the reason why it was such a good thing was, number one, because it was compulsory. It caused children to believe that the state was more powerful than their parents, because their parents could actually go to jail if they didn't go to school. So it had to be compulsory. And that what that produces is a level of respect for and fear of the state. Number two, it had to be... You had to have a system where the children had to ask if they could ask a question before they asked the question. There was raise your hand and wait to be called on. So it bred compliance. Number three, every issue, every category in education was broken into its separate class. So instead of learning holistically, instead of learning all together, you know, a whole bunch of things, instead of learning math while you're in shop class as you're learning how to use calculus to calculate a circular floor, you would simply learn it in the abstract. And what this did is it discouraged holistic thinking and it encouraged linear thinking. So people thought in separate categories. And finally, in order to really regiment people, each topic had a particular amount of time and a bell went off at the end of that time for people to move from class to class. And the classes were segregated according to topic. And Horace Mann's argument was that this produced people who were more compliant citizens. They were less likely to revolt. Better workers in the factory, they were less likely to challenge management, and they were more likely, they were preconditioned to wait for the bell and not to talk back and to put the screw on the bolt over and over and over again. And number three, good soldiers for the army who wouldn't shoot until they were told that they saw the whites of the eye and all that kind of thing. And he said this would be a great social good for the United States because the Wild West was happening and we had just suffered a god-awful civil war. And he said you'll never have another civil war because you'll have good, compliant citizens. And nobody took his bait. He ran around trying to sell this to governments and cities and states all over the country. And everybody said, not sure I want to do that. Government pay for education? He said, well, you know, it's also an investment in the future. I mean, that was sort of the secondary thing. Finally, Boston was having this problem. There was it was called the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner. It was a secret society, sort of like the Masons, you know. It was a secret society that wasn't secret. They were actually quite proud of themselves. And they had a secret handshake. I don't know if they wore special underwear like the Masons do and the Mormons do, but they had a special handshake. And when you did the special handshake, you said, I know nothing, which was the secret slogan. And so they were referred to as the know-nothings. And they took control. This was a Protestant, by the way, secret society. And they took control of the Massachusetts legislature in the late 1870s. And this is referred to, and you can, you know, Google this or look it up. It's in history books. If you've studied history of the Northeast or of education, this was referred to as the Know-Nothing Legislature of the 1780s or the early 1790s, that period of time. Because the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner slogan was, I know nothing. So they were having a problem. Being a Protestant secret society that ran the state of Massachusetts, they had a majority of the seats in the legislature. And in the late 1840s, early 1850s, during and after the Irish potato famine, there were literally millions, about 2 million Irish, who came from Ireland to the United States, and many of them settled in Boston. So what was happening now, you know, 30 years later, this was the second generation. This was the children of the immigrants. The immigrants were willing to get beat up and get lousy working conditions and you know, put up with all kinds of crap and be second-class citizens. But their children weren't. Their children thought of themselves as Americans, although they were Irish Catholics. And so the Protestant Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, the secret society, they were like, you know, what are we going to do? Because the Catholics were outnumbering the Protestants in Boston, and they were starting to acquire political power in the city government in Boston. And they were creating these enclaves, these entire communities that were Catholic and Irish, and maintaining their ethnic identity, as it were. And so Horace Mann came to the legislature in Massachusetts, and he said, I'll tell you how to break the back of the Irish, how to break the back of the Catholics, how to do away with this problem that you have of being challenged politically by people who are of a different religion, because back then the chasm between Protestant and Catholic was huge. In fact, in some states, there was the discrimination against Catholics was massive. Catholics weren't allowed to vote in some states or some counties. And keep in mind, Jack Kennedy was our first Catholic president. There were a lot of people who said, oh, America will never elect a Catholic. So Horace Mann's solution was impose mandatory, compulsory public education and do it the way that I said. You know, break each subject into its own class, have bells between them, have the teachers be ultimate authority figures. The children must ask before they can ask a question. They can't walk around during the class. They can't fidget. They can't get off topic. All these things. And the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner said, sure, we'll give it a try. And there were actually a half a dozen families in the Boston area who so fought this because they wanted to educate their own kids at home or in their own little community-run schools. That so fought this that the National Guard had to be mobilized in Massachusetts to escort these kids to school. So when you consider the history of education in the United States, you get it, that it's not always been just about education. Nora in Minneapolis. By the way, Nora, I see Citibank in the header here. Before you get to this, Walter Wriston was the head of Citicorp, and in his book, The Twilight of Sovereignty, in which he said that, you know, basically we don't need a United States of America anymore, he said, quote, markets are the only true voting machines. If they are left untouched by politicians and regulations, they will truly act out the people's will for the first time in history. What's up, Nora?
Is that the free market theory?
Yeah.
Well, I still believe that that one guy that said that the free markets can't be free markets if the main drugs that people buy and use and want aren't included, then their economy is going to fall down, and it did. But I was calling about the Citibank getting the money and the people screaming about it.
Right.
Starting out when they were first going to give this $800 billion or whatever, and I was calling my beloved Congressman Keith Ellison's office saying, the most important basic driver about this economy is the foreclosures. Well, because I watch these people on Charlie Rose and everything. I just classes all day long and night on TV for me. So the most important thing was about the foreclosures causing the prices going down, and the prices going down causing the foreclosures.
Yeah.
So now last week, the news came out, Citibank was voluntarily rewriting all these
I think this was their, in fact,
foreclosures, so they deserve the reward.
Right, exactly. In fact, I think we had them on the show here, and that really was what it was all about. Thanks a lot, Martha. I appreciate the call.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, helping you win the water cooler wars.
Baby, take off your coat. Real slow.
That's because the NSA is listening.
Baby, take off your shoes. I'll take your shoes.
And they're passing the info to George Bush.
Baby, take off your dress. Yes, yes, yes.
And Dick Cheney is reading it or listening to the tapes.
Can't leave your hat on.
Keep your hat on.
Can't leave your hat on.
Especially if it's a tinfoil hat. That's what we thought at first, right, when these reports came out that the NSA was listening in on Americans, listening in on people around the world who were not terrorists. And George W. Bush was saying, nah, we're only listening to terrorists. It's only the terrorists we're listening to. Turns out now, they were listening to Tony Blair. Yep, the former Prime Minister of Great Britain. And to Mr. Al Yaour, the first Prime Minister of Iraq. We were listening to Pillow Talk. Yep. David Murphy Falk told ABC News he saw and read a file on Blair's private life and heard Pillow Talk phone calls of Al Yaour when he worked as an Army Arab linguist assigned to a secret NSA facility at Fort Gordon, Georgia, between 2003 and 2007.
This is mine to talk you.
You betcha.
Trying to tear us apart.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, when Tony Blair finds out that George W. Bush has been listening to him and Sherry having a good time, shall we say, in the bedroom, I suspect his stock is going to go down a little bit with the Bush family. Don't you think? Carl in Washougal, Washington. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Just first want to compliment you. I love the program. And then getting back to the discussion on the compulsory education, what I found as a tremendous resource was the work by John Taylor Gatto, the book Dumbing Us Down originally, and then he has a new one out called The Underground History of Compulsory Education.
And this is one of those interesting confluence things. I know John. I don't know him, you know, really well and personally, but I've spoken with him, and And we have used each other's materials over the years. I've probably used far more of his than he mine, but we've quoted each other in our books. And John's a very conservative or very libertarian guy, and I'm not. I'm an advocate of public education, and I'm not sure that I could say the same of John Taylor Gatto, but his books are very enlightening. And when you get it how public education came about, a lot of its dysfunctions make perfect sense. I think that we ought to go back to the notions that Thomas Jefferson had. Thomas Jefferson, when he wrote his own epitaph for his own tombstone, he chose not to put on it that he was president of the United States. He didn't think that was the most important thing. He put on it that he was the founder of the Bill for Religious Freedom, and one other thing, which I forget, I think that maybe that he was an inventor, and that he was the founder, and third, and perhaps most important in his mind, that he was the founder of the University of Virginia, which was a free college. The whole idea was anybody can go to college for free. Anybody can get an education for free. And in Jefferson's mind, it was not about creating, and Carl, thank you for, you know, well said, it was not about creating good robots for industry or good soldiers for the military. It was about creating an educated populace, because Jefferson believed that you can't have a functioning democracy if you don't have a well-educated populace. And, you know, so right, so well said. Peter in Toronto, Canada. Hey, Peter, what's up?
I just find our own national politics so boring, I thought I'd come on Air America and listen to what you guys are talking about.
Sometimes boring is good, Peter.
Oh, it is boring. Thanks to MSNBC, I've been watching coverage of this gay bill rights thing in California.
Prop 8, yeah.
And we put that to bed two, three years ago. Gay marriage is quite legal up here now.
Right, everywhere in the country, in Canada, yeah.
We've even had our first gay divorce. That was just irony on top of everything else.
Yeah, well, it happens.
This is in a country that was founded on the principle that religious education would be guaranteed by the government for Catholics and Protestants.
Oh, that's interesting. Do they guarantee it for Muslims?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There
and
is
for
no
Wiccans?
I don't know about that. But back in the 1860s, because you had the French in Quebec who were mainly Catholic.
Right.
The English in Ontario were mainly Protestant. The Catholics were afraid that their right to a religious education would be stomped on, and the government said, no, we're not going to do that back in the day. And now it's almost like the complete role reversal where the gay people here have more rights than gay people in America. And I thought, well, that's strange. But
well, it's not hard to have more rights than gay people in America. I mean, the gay people in America right now are in many ways in the same place that African Americans were in the United States in 1950. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could argue that it's even worse. I see this as the next civil rights issue. But Peter, thanks a lot for the call. You know, well said. Let's see here, June in Portland, Oregon. June, we just have a few seconds to wrap up the show. You're in.
Real quick, then. I'm in excellent health, 84. No medication other than aspirin for arthritis. I exercise. I'm fanatic about exercise, and highly suspicious of the pharmaceutical industry, money-earning industry, and the healthcare industry.
Yeah, I agree with you, June, and I know that one of your sons is a physician, so that's coming from a high source, all of you. Coming up tomorrow, Ronnie Deutsch, tax expert and attorney, common sense advice on protecting your retirement savings. Should you cash out of your 401k or ride the market ups and downs? Plus, Mark Anderson of the Strategic News Service stops by to address his theory that Japan just dropped on us the economic equivalent of a neutron bomb. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.